doing this to yourself, Cherie said. Everything's going to be fine. He's not the only one dealing with the crisis. We're not the only ones. There's a long road ahead, but everyone's going to be all right. Clark will be all right. Jende smiled to himself when Cherie said this, hoping so, too, fervently wishing Mr. Edwards would find his way out of the despondency he'd been enveloped in for months. The previous night, after work, Clark had called his friend Frank to ponder if it was time for him to get away from the street. It wasn't worthwhile anymore, he'd said, and he was getting tired of the bullshit that came with everything else. He'd never cared about what people thought of him, but all of a sudden he did. He was watching those assholes on MSNBC and agreeing with them, and the fact that the whole country had turned against the likes of him was completely justifiable. He couldn't help but feel somewhat responsible for the shit that was happening, he told Frank. Not because he had personally done anything to hurt anyone, but because he was part of the system, and no matter how much he hated to admit it, or how much he wished Lehman hadn't lost its principles, or how badly he'd wished there was more conscience on the street, he was part of it. And because of his involvement in lots of bullshit he didn't even agree with, however small his involvement had been, this had happened. He wasn't sure about a future at Barclays. It wasn't anything about the bank. It was him. Maybe he was just getting old. Maybe he was beginning to question the meaning of his life. Why was he all of a sudden sounding like Vince? Hearing Vince's name had made Jende wonder how the young man was faring in India. He thought about Vince whenever he saw a mention of India in the newspaper, but didn't think it right to ask Clark about him and open up whatever wounds were still healing. He thought about Leah, too, in the days after Lehman fell, but had no way of reaching her besides through the number at Lehman. The thought of calling it left him with an eerie feeling, as if doing so would be akin to calling a dead friend at a cemetery. But he worried about her high blood pressure and her swelling feet. And so a few days after returning to work, he had called the work number, hoping for a recorded message that would direct him to her. Leah? He said, shocked and elated when she answered the phone. What are you doing there? I thought... I was afraid.
Oh yeah, honey, she said. I was scared too. My last day's tomorrow. They want me to clean up some things before I leave. Otherwise, I don't need to be here for one more minute.
I am so sorry, Leah.
I am too. But what are you gonna do? Sometimes it's better when it happens, you know? You spend months losing sleep, fearing for what's ahead. At least now it's happened and it's over, and I don't know. I can finally sleep well and get the hell out of this shitty place.
It's the fear that kills us, Leah, Jende said. Sometimes it happens, and it is not even as bad as the fear. That is what I have learned in this life. It is the fear. Leah agreed, but said she couldn't talk much at the moment. She gave Jende her home number to call later, which Jende did that night. What are you going to do now? He asked her.
Something really great,
she said, sounding more upbeat than she had in the morning.
I've got over 20 years of experience, honey. I'm not worried. I'm gonna take a month and relax before I start a job search.
You should do that.
I will. Maybe go see my sister in Florida. That's the good thing about a life with no husband or children. No one to hold me back. Make me feel as if I can't go where I want, whenever I want, do what I want. I'm gonna enjoy myself in Sarasota. And when I come back, I'll dust off the old resume.
You will get a new job very fast when you return, Jende said. Mr. Edwards will surely tell everyone that you were a good secretary.
He better.
When you come back, call me, please. You are going to let me know you are all right?
Leah promised she would, and Jende wished her a good time in Florida. The next day, as he drove to drop off and pick up the Edwardses, Jende thought about Leah and the ex-Lehman employees. He thought about the state of the city and the state of the country. He thought about how strange and sad and scary it was, that Americans were talking about an economic crisis. A phrase Cameroonians heard on the radio and TV virtually every day in the late 80s, when the country entered a prolonged financial downturn. Few people in Limbe understood the origin of the slump, or what the government was doing to get the country out of it and prevent a recurrence. But everyone knew that it made buying food and other necessities beyond difficult, thanks to the evaporation of large amounts of money. Now it was happening in America, and it was bad, very bad. No one could tell how long it would take before this avoidable pandemonium that Lehman's fall had caused would end. It could take years, the experts on TV said. Maybe up to 5 years, some said, especially now that the crisis was spreading around the world and people were losing secure jobs, losing life savings, losing families, losing sanities. But him, thank God, he still had a job. His gratitude overflowed every time he picked up the car from the garage, knowing he could be jobless like many all over the country. He read of job losses daily in Clark's discarded journal, and watched news segments about layoffs on CNN after work. Every night he went to bed, hoping it would get better soon, but it would only get worse in the coming weeks. More jobs would be lost, with no hope of being found in the immediate future. The Dow would drop in titanic percentages. It would rise and fall and rise and fall over and over like a demonic wave. 401ks would be cut in half, disappear as if stolen by maleficent aliens. Retirements would have to be postponed. Visions of lazy days at the beach would vanish or be put on hold for up to a decade. College education funds would be withdrawn. Many hands would never know the feel of a desired diploma. Dream homes would not be bought. Dream wedding plans would be reconsidered. Dream vacations would not be taken, no matter how many days had been worked in the past year, no matter how much respite was needed. In many different ways, it would be an unprecedented plague, a calamity like the one that had befallen the Egyptians in the Old Testament. The only difference between the Egyptians then and the Americans now, Jende reasoned, was that the Egyptians had been cursed by their own wickedness. They had called an abomination upon their land by worshipping idols and enslaving their fellow humans, all so they could live in splendor. They had chosen riches over righteousness, rapaciousness over justice. The Americans had done no such thing. And yet, all through the land, willows would weep for the end of many dreams. Chapter 28. They drove to the Chelsea Hotel at least a dozen times in the first 5 weeks after Lehman fell. Clark seemed to need those appointments more as hysteria in the market grew and the weight on his weakening shoulders got heavier. He seemed to need them desperately, like a scorched land panting for rain. It was as if they were his sole path to aliveness, his sole means of feeling sane in a demented world. Only when he called to confirm each appointment did his tone change from morose to expectant. Always he confirmed the rendezvous on the way there. Always, he verified with the person on the phone that the girl would do the acts she had promised to do on the website. Always, he nodded and sometimes smiled as the person assured him that he would get his money's worth, that the girl would make him very, very happy. In the driver's seat, Jende pretended not to hear anything. It was his job to drive, not to hear. Before every appointment, he pulled up in front of the hotel, dropped Clark off, and searched for a spot on the street. There, he waited until he got a call from Clark to pick him up in 5 minutes. When Clark re-entered the car, Jende saw a man who looked relaxed, but in other ways was no different from the man who had exited. His hair was combed back, as when he left the car. His blue shirt was without wrinkles, his collar without a dent. No guilt was evident in his demeanor. Jende drove him wherever he needed to be next and asked no questions. He had no right to ask questions. Sometimes when Clark re-entered the car, he made remarks about the weather, the Yankees, the Giants. Jende always responded quickly and agreed with whatever the boss said, as if to say, "It's okay, sir. It's perfectly all right, sir, what you're doing." And he could tell Clark felt that way around him. that Clark trusted him and knew that no one would ever know. Without speaking of it, their bond had been firmly established. They were two men bound by this secret, by their dependence on each other to move forward every day and carry each other to the achievement of daily and lifelong goals, by the relationship they had forged after almost a year of cruising on highways and sitting in rush hour traffic. Theirs was as solid a bond as could be between a man and his chauffeur, but not solid enough for the chauffeur to venture into a delicate territory, which was why Jende said no more than was necessary the night Clark returns to the car without his tie on. On any other day, Jende wouldn't have noticed the tie's disappearance, since he cared little about ties. Winston had given him one, after Jende told him what Clark had said at the job interview, about him getting a real tie if he hopes to further his career. But he'd rejected Winston's offer to teach him how to tie it, believing he still remembered how to do it from the couple of times he'd worn one in Limbe. On the morning of his first day on the job, though, neither he nor Nenny could figure out how to tie it. Nenny had suggested they Google it, but he didn't have the time for that. He'd gone to work with a clip-on, and Clark had complimented his more professional look, which Jende took as a validation of everything he was wearing. Later that week, Winston had again offered to teach him, but he'd declined because he found it unnecessary. And besides, why did a man have to tie his neck like a goat? Few ties seemed worth the discomfort, but Mr. Edwards's blue tie had gotten his attention that morning when he picked him up. It was a tie of many flags, and at a stoplight, Jende had looked at it through the rearview mirror and recognized the British Union Jack, the American Stars and Stripes, the Drapeau Tricolore of France, Il Tricolore of Italy, flags he knew from years of watching the World Cup. He had searched for the Cameroonian green, red, and yellow flag with a yellow star on the red, but it wasn't there, though the Malian flag was there for some reason. While waiting for Clark in front of the Chelsea Hotel that night, he considered making conversation about the tie when the boss re-entered the car, partly to diffuse the awkwardness that often sat between them in the first minutes after Clark returned, and partly because if he was going to spend money on a real tie, he wanted it to be something notable, and he was hoping Mr. Edwards could tell him where he could get a cheap version of his tie, since his was probably from one of those rich people stores on Fifth Avenue. But Clark had returned to the car without the tie. Jende had opened his mouth to say something and immediately shut it. He had no right to comment on the boss's appearance, and it wasn't his place to speculate where the tie could be, though he couldn't stop himself from wondering. It couldn't be in Clark's briefcase. He never took the briefcase into the hotel. It couldn't be in his pocket. That would make no sense. And he couldn't have given it to whomever he had just...
Back to the office, sir?
Jende asked as he pulled out of a parking spot in front of the hotel, wondering how much pleasure the man must have received for him to forget his tie.
No. Home.
Home, sir?
That's what I said.
Immediately, Jende could see how this was going to play out. Clark was going to walk into the house, and Cindy, being a woman, and being as inquisitive as women couldn't help being, was going to ask him where the tie was. Clark was going to stammer and quickly mutter a lie, which Cindy would not believe. Cindy would start a fight, maybe their third fight of the day, and tomorrow Jende's ears would be subjected to more cringe-inducing details about their marriage. And poor Clark, as if he wasn't suffering enough, would have one more battle to fight. Or maybe Cindy wouldn't notice. It was already 10 o'clock, and she might be sleeping. Clark would return home, undress, take a shower, and thankfully, the poor woman wouldn't know a thing. Chapter 29 Cindy asked him to come upstairs on an early evening in November, a week after the tie went missing. It was 3 days after Barack Obama had been elected president, and New Yorkers had danced in Times Square. 3 days after he and Nenny had jumped all around the living room and shed euphoric tears that the son of an African now ruled the world. It was a day after Clark had told him that he would be getting a $2,000 raise for having been an exceptional employee for one full year.
Please, have a seat,
Cindy said, pointing to a chair at the kitchen table. Jende lowered himself onto the black leather dining chair. There was a clear vase of fresh purple calla lilies on the rectangular marble table. A blue notebook sat next to it. Jende glanced at the leather-bound book, and then Cindy. He could tell. She had noticed the tie. She must have noticed the tie. They must have fought about it or about something else. It must have been a big fight. Maybe a fight like the one Nani had told him they'd had in the Hamptons over Vince moving to India. It was always easy to tell when a married person had had an ugly fight with their spouse. They looked as if the whole world had deserted them, as if they had nothing and no one. That was how Cindy looked that evening. She no longer looked like the gorgeous Mrs. Edwards from when he started working for them. Her skin was still beautiful, wrinkle-free and spotless, but there was an emptiness in her eyes, which even her well-done mascara and eyeliner could not conceal. And he could see that something had happened to the madame. Something was happening to her. Even with the loose waves of her glossy strawberry blonde hair lying on one side of her face, her pearls sitting on her chest, her lips painted red, it was clear to Jende how much pain she was in, and how badly she needed something to happen to bring her peace. "How was your day?" she asked him. "I thank God, madame." She nodded, picked up her coffee mug from the table, and holding it with both hands, took a sip. "Your wife and son are well?"
"They are very well, madame. I thank you for asking."
Cindy nodded again. She said nothing for 10 seconds, maybe, and bowed her head while her hands remained clasped around the mug.
"I'm going to need you to do me a favor," she said softly, lifting her head to look into Jende's eyes.
"A huge favor. I need you to start doing it tomorrow."
"Anything, madame. Anything."
"Good. Good." She paused again, nodding with her head bowed. He waited, looking at the collar of her yellow cotton blouse in lieu of her face. She kept her head bowed. He glanced around the kitchen, at the bare countertops, and the trio of glass pendant lights above the island. Just when it seemed she was going to remain with her head down for a full minute, she lifted it, pushed back her hair, and looked into his eyes.
"I want you to write in here," she said, pushing the blue notebook toward him, "everywhere that you drive Clark to, everyone you see him with. I want you to write everything in here."
Jende shifted in his seat and sat upright.
"You don't have to tell him what I'm asking you to do, okay? This will be between the two of us. Just do as I say. Everything will be all right. You'll be fine."
Her voice was guttural, her nose reddish at the top. She pulled a tissue from a box on the table, wiped her nose, stood up, discarded it in the trash can, and returned to her seat. Jende picked up the notebook and examined it. He flipped through the empty pages, turned it around as if to make sure it really was a book. Carefully, he put the book down, took a breath, clasped his hands on his lap, and waited for courage to possess him so he could give her the right response.
"Mrs. Edwards," he said, "what you are asking me to do is very difficult."
"I know.
What you are asking me is...
In fact, madame, I can lose my job with Mr. Edwards if I do something like this.
Mr. Edwards made it very clear to me..."
"You will not lose your job," she said. "I'll make sure of that. You work for the whole family, not just him. Get me what I want, and I'll make sure you keep your job."
"But, madame..."
His voice trailed off. It had suddenly become too heavy to flow.
"Madame," he began again, "surely you must know that this is a very difficult time for Mr. Edwards. I see how much he is working, madame. I can see how hard this time is for him. He looks tired. He's working so hard, always on his cell phone, always on his computer, one meeting after another.
I don't need you to tell me what a hard-working man my husband is.
Yes, madame. Of course, madame.
There's another woman, Cindy said. She paused and turned her face away as if ashamed of confessing her fear to a mere chauffeur.
What do you know?
She asked him.
I know nothing, madame.
Where have you driven them to?
I swear to you, madame,
do not lie to me.
Her hands were shivering. His were cold. He couldn't recall his hands having ever been this cold indoors.
He yearned to reach across the table, steady her hands, tell her not to worry or fear. He couldn't bring himself to do it. He had no right to touch the madame. Still, he had to caution her.
Madame, he said, I hope you do not take this the wrong way, madame. But please do not worry yourself too much.
Cindy shook her head and laughed, a weak, derisive laugh.
I just think, madame, that whatever you think Mr. Edwards is doing, or wherever you think he is just working, and working all the time. It is not easy for a woman. Any woman, madame. It is hard for my wife, too, with me not coming home until late most of the time, and sometimes I have to work weekends. But she understands that I have to do this to take care of the family, just as Mr. Edwards has to.
Cindy nodded.
Your wife is pregnant, right? She said.
Yes, madame, he said, pushing out a flimsy smile. The baby will be coming next month.
That's nice. You still don't know if it's a boy or a girl?
No, madame, we still do not know. We will find out on the baby's birthday.
Well, Jende, she said, think about your pregnant wife and your new baby. Think about your family and your situation. Think very carefully, and let me know if you'd like to have a job to support them.
She stood up, wished him a good night, and walked out of the room.
Chapter 30. He returned home early that evening, around 8 o'clock, to find Winston eating kwakoko and banga soup at the table. Two blue enamel serving bowls were on the table, one bowl containing 10-inch-long sticks of grated and boiled cocoyams, the other holding palm nut soup with pieces of smoked turkey neck peeking from beneath the oil swimming on top. There was a plate of snails, too, fried in tomato, onions, cilantro, and shiitake mushrooms.
You'll never guess who I'm going to see next weekend,
Winston said as Jende washed his hands to join him at the table, while Nenny set up another plate.
Mommy? Jende asked.
How did you guess?
As if I only met you today. What other woman will make your eyes sparkle like that?
Winston smiled.
I found her on Facebook, he said.
Facebook? Jende said.
This Facebook thing is something else, eh?
Nenny?
Didn't you just find your cousin who moved to some country over there?
Nenny nodded on the sofa without taking her eyes off her Oprah magazine.
He doesn't call home or send his mother money, she said. But Timbutuku has time to show the whole world pictures of his new shoes and clothes on Facebook. I'm telling you, it's something else, this Facebook wahala,
Winston said.
I joined the thing for 1 minute. I see one friend from BHS connect to another friend. Before I know, I'm looking at Mami's picture. Her makandi still as Manyaka Malambo as it was in high school. Kai!
He clapped his hands and spread them to show the full width of the buttocks.
That same night I call her. We talk till 2 o'clock in the morning.
She's not married. She says she has a boyfriend, a little white thing down there in Texas. We'll see about that when she sees me with her two eyes again.
Jende chuckled with his mouth full.
When you see her, he said after he'd swallowed, just ask her to compare the snakes. Whoever has the longer one that can glide in and out fastest wins.
Gender,
Nenny said, widening her eyes and motioning with her lips toward Leomi.
Uncle has a snake?
Leomi asked, turning from the TV.
Yes,
Winston said, laughing.
And you are not allowed to see it.
But Uncle...
Stop asking stupid questions to grown people and go do your homework,
Jende yelled.
Don't shout at him because of that,
Nenny retorted after Leomi had gone into the bedroom.
You guys are the ones who started it.
Then he should have closed his ears.
Why should he close his ears? Because children...
Married people,
Winston exclaimed, throwing his oily hands up.
Stop with your bickering before I swear off marriage forever. I'm begging you.
Nenny gave Jende a dirty look and returned to her magazine.
How Bolobo?
Winston asked Jende.
Condition is critical, Jende said, before recounting the story of his meeting with Cindy.
Nenny put her magazine down to listen.
You have to tell her what you know,
she said after Jende was done telling the story. Her hand was on her belly, her swollen feet on a stool.
I believe it's my right to know everything about you. It's her right to know everything about her husband, too.
Winston nodded as he ripped the skin and meat off a piece of turkey neck.
Ah, you women, Jende said. You worry too much. Why do you want to know all of a man's business, eh?
I don't want to know all of your business. Sometimes I hear you talking to your friends on the phone, and I don't even want to hear what you're saying to them.
Well, that's you,
Nenny said.
It doesn't mean it's the same for everyone. I don't want to know where you went and who you saw every day and all that, but some wives want to know. Some husbands want to know, too. That is okay by me.
So you don't mind if I start asking your friends about you?
If you want to call my friends right now and ask them something about me, you can call them. My hands are clean. There is nothing my friends are going to tell you that is different from who you think I am.
Eh, truly.
What do you mean, truly?
I mean, if I ask your friends, they won't tell me that you've been doing dirty things with one of those African-American men on the street with pants falling down their legs.
He said, winking at her. Winston laughed.
New Yorkers, come and hear something,
Nenny said, raising her hands.
Why would I ever do that? Why would I take one of the ones with no job and five baby mamas? I beg, oh. If I ever want to try something new, I'll find me a nice old white man with lots of money and an oxygen tank.
Not a bad idea,
Winston said.
We could all split his money when he goes.
Nenny and Winston cackled together and gave each other an air high five.
But seriously, Jende said, women have to learn to be more trusting. They have to trust their husbands that they know what they're doing.
I have to agree with Nenny, Bo,
Winston said.
You have to tell her.
Have you guys been drinking kwacha?
I cannot ever say anything about what he does to anyone.
I don't have any business talking about him. I signed a contract when he hired me, you remember?
Yes,
Nenny said, standing up to clear the table.
So?
The contract said I cannot discuss anything about him with anybody, even his wife.
Forget the contract,
Winston said.
Ah, Boo, how can you say that when you're a lawyer?
How can you tell me to do something that you know can make me lose my job?
But what are you afraid of telling her?
Nenny asked, walking back from the kitchen.
Do you know something that he's hiding from her?
Jende did not reply. He'd wanted to tell her for a long time. When he first found out about the women, he thought it would be nice for her to know so they could gossip about it late at night. Laugh about Mr. Edwards booking an appointment with a tall woman or a blonde woman. Whenever he dropped Mr. Edwards at the Chelsea Hotel, he would tell her about it and they would laugh, and she would be grateful that he would never do such a thing because he was a good man, an honorable man, a man of integrity. But the more he thought about it, the more he realized how differently it could play out if he told her. She might become suspicious, even anxious. She would think, what if Mr. Edwards offered him a prostitute too, as some sort of gift or bonus? What if Mr. Edwards indoctrinated him, contaminated him, made him feel as if it was every man's God-given right to satisfy himself as often as he needed to. He could see her becoming needlessly terrified, especially now that her face had grown fat, her legs had grown fat, and her whole body looked like it would be fat for years to come. Which didn't bother him. Didn't bother him at all. But he knew that she thought he cared, which was why she bought all those magazines with skinny women on the cover and made sure she didn't put too much palm oil in the food. Now she was talking about weight loss and calories and cholesterol and sugar-free this and fat-free that and stupid things no one in Limbe talked about. Now she was beginning to worry about nonsense. She was becoming a fearful wife. He loved her so much. He wouldn't have traded her even for an American passport. But he could understand why she was afraid. He was the only man she'd ever loved, just like her father was the only man her mother had ever loved. And then what happened? 24 years into their marriage, the year after her father lost his job at the seaport, her mother found out that her father had impregnated a teenager who lived in Potapota quarters. Her mother had been humiliated. Neni had been humiliated more than her mother, if such a thing were possible. Her mother had caught her crying and yelled at her. "Wipe those tears," she'd said. "Men are ruled by a thing they cannot control." Neni had wanted to yell back at her mother and tell her to stop justifying her husband acting as if his unhappiness was everyone's fault. She'd wanted to scream at her for staying married to an angry man who scolded her in front of her children. But she knew that with only a part-time secretarial job and 8 children, her mother would struggle to start a new life. So she had dried her eyes and decided on that day that there was one thing she wanted in a man above all else. Loyalty. And that was the one thing that Jende was best at above all other men she'd ever known, keeping his promises.
"Do you know something?"
she asked him again. "Why would he share his secret with me?" he said to her. "I'm his driver, not his friend."
"Then so?"
she said.
"Tell her. I wouldn't try to anger Mrs. Edwards if I were you." "I agree with Neni," Winston said.
He was now sitting on the sofa with Neni, while Jende sat alone at the table.
"The moment Neni told us about the woman and her drugs, I knew something was not right with her."
"That doesn't mean..."
"That means that, Bo, this woman can make you lose your job."
"Rubbish."
"It's not rubbish, Jens. Women can be very determined," Winston said. "If you don't give her what she wants, you could lose your job. He hired you, but she can fire you. I'm telling you."
"But what am I supposed to do about that?" Jende said. "Why can't she ask her own husband what she's concerned about?"
"Who knows what kind of marriage they have? The kinds of marriage people have in this country, oh, very strange. It's not like back home, where a man can do as he sees fit, and a woman follows him. Over here, it's reversed. Women tell their men what they want, and the men do it. Because they say, happy wife, happy life. This society is funny."
"So what do you think I should do?" Jende asked Winston.
Winston looked at his cousin intently and scowled.
"I just thought of something," he said, crossing his legs and folding his arms.
"What?" Jende asked.
Winston uncrossed his legs, stood up, and untucked his shirt.
"This house," he said, "it's so hot someone can fry puff puff in the air."
He walked over to the window and cracked it open by 2 inches.
"You guys should leave this window."
"Forget about the window and come tell us something useful," Neni said.
"Okay, okay, here's what I'm thinking," he said,
beaming as he walked back to the sofa and sat next to Neni, loosening his tie in the process.
"This is what you should do. But you have to do it without any worrying about if something goes wrong."
"This one,"
Neni said after a scoff.
"His worrying is something else. Just tell us. If he cannot do it, I'll do it."
"No, he has to do it himself."
Jende nodded. Winston sat up and leaned forward.
"This is what you do,"
he said, looking at Chende.
You go up to the woman. Not tomorrow, maybe in 2 days' time, so she knows you've had time to think about it, eh?
Chende nodded again.
You see her, and you look her right in the eye.
Don't do that thing where you're talking and avoiding people's eyes, acting like a mbutuku because you're afraid. Can you just tell me the idea already?
You say to her, Madame, I thought about what you want and I understand. But I'm sorry, Madame, I cannot do it.
Here, Winston opened his arms and shrugged. Then he creased his brow.
She's going to say, how dare you? This is the end of you, no more job.
And then you look at her right inside her eyes and say, Madame, I don't want to hurt you, but you fire me.
I tell everyone about the drugs. What?
Jende exclaimed.
Mamma mia, Winston,
Nanny said, high-fiving Winston.
Are you guys crazy?
You want to keep your job or not?
I want to keep my job, but...
But what?
Nanny said.
I'm not going to do this to a poor woman who looks like she has so much of her own troubles. I mean, you guys are sitting here talking as if she's just a stranger on the street to me.
She's nothing to you,
Nanny said.
You think tomorrow you lose your job, she'll remember your name?
You're just a black man who drives her around,
Winston said.
I'm telling you, Bo, if you know the things I know about this kind of white people, you wouldn't worry about her.
I'm not worried about her,
Jende said. A line of sweat ran down the right side of his face.
You guys think I'm stupid? I know I'm only a chauffeur. But that doesn't mean I shouldn't feel sorry for her. I mean, I was looking at her as she spoke to me today, and tears filled my eyes.
Eh?
Nanny said, raising the left side of her upper lip.
So you're sorry for her, eh? You know what, baby? If she decides you're going to lose your job, guess whose eyes are going to fill up with tears? Mine.
Mr. Edwards will never fire me because of his wife.
I hope so,
Winston said, looking at his cell phone.
He'll never do it. He's not that kind of a man.
Don't trust another man like that, Boo. People have many different colors.
Let's leave the topic alone, please. I'll handle it right. I won't lose my job.
Nanny pursed her lips, muttered something under her breath, and leaned back with her arms folded.
Have I showed you guys Mommy's picture?
Winston asked. He picked up his iPhone and tapped on it a few times to bring up a picture of his high school girlfriend. A pretty painted face with a long weave and plentiful cleavage. He showed it to Nanny, who nodded and passed on the phone to Jende, who, knowing Nanny's eyes were on him, carelessly acknowledged that Mommy would make a very fine Mrs. Winston Avera.
You have to do what Winston says,
Nanny said, her arm still folded over her high belly.
The only way you can escape this is to shut her up. Because if you tell her something Mr. Edwards doesn't want her to know, Mr. Edwards will fire you for breaking the contract. If she ever finds out you knew something and didn't tell her, she'll fire you for lying to her. She won't care if you have a family or if...
Nanny, please, let me rest. I'm begging you. My head is aching, okay?
My head is aching too, okay? I don't like this situation at all. I know Mrs. Edwards. I know what kind of woman she is. She looks like she is weak, but she gets what she wants from people, one way or another. You cannot make any mistake with your job right now, let me tell you. One little mistake, you lose your job at a time when...
You think I don't know that?
Everyone calm down,
Winston said.
And Bo, please, don't talk to our woman like that. Not especially when she's carrying our fine American baby.
Maybe a woman carrying a baby should know when to stop talking.
Nanny looked at Jende from head to toe, her momentary disdain unconcealed. She sat up and started lifting herself off the sofa. Winston stood up and pulled her to her feet.
put some sense into that coconut head of his, she said to Winston. Because if I say one more thing to him, I swear to you, my mouth will start bleeding like a slaughtered cow's.
Jende and Winston chuckled as Nenny bade Winston good night and waddled into the bedroom. How did I get myself involved in other people's married business like this? Jende asked Winston after Nenny had closed the bedroom door. This one is beyond me.
Women can be very tricky, Winston said. If you don't give her what she wants, she'll go to him and make up a story about you so that he'll do away with you.
Then I'll become like Joseph in Egypt.
Yes, you'll be like Joseph in Egypt, but instead of solving a dream about 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine, you'll be living in 7 years of hardship.
Chapter 31 On the morning of his 38th birthday, he stood outside the car and held the back door open for Clark Edwards, as he did every workday morning. He was dressed in a suit Nenny had bought for him at Target as his birthday gift, a gray wool ensemble that he paired with a white shirt and red clip-on tie, and completed with a pair of brown dress shoes. Earlier that morning, as he'd stood in front of the mirror admiring himself, Nenny had walked into the bedroom and told him he looked more handsome than ever, and he had agreed, giving her a long thank-you kiss.
"Today is my birthday, sir," he told Clark.
"Happy birthday, then," Clark replied, without taking his eyes off his laptop, which was booting up. "I won't ask how old you are."
"Thank you, sir," Jende replied, smiling.
While they waited for the light to turn green at Park and 70th, he pondered how best to bring up the topic.
"I know this is a very busy time for you, sir," he said, "but there is something I wanted to discuss with you."
"Go on," Clark said, still not lifting his eyes from the laptop.
"It is about Mrs. Edwards, sir,"
Clark continued, looking at his laptop.
"What about her?"
"Sir, I think she wants to know where you go to, and who you see, and all those kinds of things, sir. She wants me to tell her about what I see you doing."
Clark looked at Jende in the rearview mirror.
"Really?"
Jende nodded.
"I do not know what to do, sir. That is why I am asking you."
He wanted to turn around to see the reaction on Clark's face. Rage, disappointment, frustration, but he couldn't. He could only catch a glimpse of the boss's eyes in the mirror.
"Tell her what she wants to know," Clark said.
"I can tell her, sir. Do you want me, sir? You want me to..."
"You can answer her questions."
"You mean I can tell her everything, sir?"
"Of course you can tell her everything. Where do you take me to that you can't talk about? Who do you see me with?"
"That is what I told her, sir.
I told her I only take you to office buildings in Midtown and downtown, and sometimes never mention Chelsea."
"I have never mentioned Chelsea, sir. I will never."
The car was silent for a minute, the men acknowledging without words what they each knew the other knew. Jende wanted Clark to know more. He wanted to assure him of his loyalty, promise him again that his secret would always be safe. He wanted to tell Mr. Edwards that because he had given him a good job that had changed his life and that was enabling him to take care of his family, send his wife to school, send his father-in-law a cash gift every few months, replace the roof and crumbling wooden walls of his parents' house, and save for the future, he would always protect him every way he could. He did not say it, but Clark Edwards said,
"Thank you,"
nonetheless. The perspiration running down Jende's back dried off.
"Thank you so much, sir, for understanding," he said. "I was not sleeping well, not knowing what to do. I am glad I can make both you and Mrs. Edwards happy."
"Of course.
I was so afraid I would lose my job if I did not do the right thing."
"There's nothing to be afraid of. Your job is secure. You've been excellent.
Continue doing as I ask you to do, and you won't have to worry about anything. Both men were silent again as the car crawled through the midtown madness of tourist shoppers and harried commuters and street vendors and city buses and tour buses and yellow cabs and black cars and children in strollers and messengers on bikes and too much of everything.
Sir, Jende said, is Mrs. Edwards doing well?
Yeah, she's fine. Why?
It looked to me, sir, as if...
Clark's phone buzzed and he picked it up. Did you talk to Cindy? He said to the person on the line.
Great.
I think she's putting you guys at the Mandarin Oriental. Not sure why.
No, it's fine, if that's what everyone prefers.
He listened for a while and then laughed.
Sounds like Mom, he said. And Dad's visit to New York is never complete without a Central Park walk.
Yeah. I'll make sure Jende is available to pick everyone up from the airport.
Me too. I'm excited. It's going to be great.
I can't remember the last time either. Maybe the year Mighty and Kayla were born, and no one was in the mood to deal with the holiday crowd with babies.
Don't worry about bringing anything, and tell Mom not to. Cindy and June are taking care of everything. They've got their menu down.
I don't think they need help. They've been doing it for years.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, then. I didn't know you'd already suggested it to her. I'm glad everyone's on the same page.
Listen, Cease, I've got to go.
Sounds good.
Sorry about that, Clark said to Jende after hanging up. We're very excited about being together in New York for the first time in so many years.
I understand the excitement, sir.
You were saying something about Cindy?
Yes, sir, Jende replied. I was just saying, sir, I don't know if it is the right thing for me to say, but it looked to me like she has lost some weight, so I just wanted to make sure that she is fine. I will be glad to do whatever is needed if she is not well, and if you need me to help around the house, sir.
That won't be necessary, but thank you. She's doing very well.
I am glad to hear that, sir, because I was a bit worried.
The recession is hard on us all, but she's doing good.
By the grace of God, sir, we will all be okay soon.
Clark picked up the Wall Street Journal lying next to him. After a few minutes of reading it, he lifted up his head and looked at Jende.
You should tell her that she lost weight, he said.
She'll be glad to hear that. Jende smiled.
Maybe I will, sir, he replied. Mrs. Edwards is a good woman.
Yeah, Clark said, returning to his newspaper. She's a good woman. Chapter 32. Twice a day, during his lunch break and before parking the car for the day, he wrote down everything he thought Cindy would love to read. Benign information, banal rundowns. He provided details that were far from necessary, included times, locations, and names that served no purpose. Added descriptions of people whose actions and behaviors contributed nothing to the narrative. This was his first chance to write something on a daily basis since his student days at National Comprehensive, so he took the opportunity to employ phrases and expressions he hadn't found a way to use in everyday conversation. Throw in words he'd learned from reading the dictionary he'd owned since secondary school. Display sentences and tenses he'd picked up from the newspaper, and which he hoped would be proof to the madame that he was thinking carefully as he wrote. On a Tuesday afternoon, he wrote, "Pick up Mr. Edwards at 7:05, but the slow traffic discombobulated Mr. Edwards because he has a meeting at 7:45. Drop Mr. Edwards at work at 7:42. Before, when we were still in the car, he called his new secretary, I continue to forget her name, and tell her he was going to be late. When I drop him in front of the office, a black woman wearing a suit is outside. It looks like she just comes out of a car, too. I see her and Mr. Edwards say hi to one another and then walk into the office together. I've seen this woman before. My brain cells fire around all day, and I remember where I saw her. She used to work at Lehman, too. It is 2:30 now, and I have not seen Mr. Edwards because he demarcate this whole time to be in the office. On a Friday evening, after driving Clark from the Chelsea Hotel to the office, he wrote, "At 4 o'clock, Mr. Edwards and I leave Washington, D.C. He gets plenty of phone call, but nothing sounds cherry and fishy. Everything sounds like work. Someone who he says this to, another person who he says that to, different work things. I do not talk to him all the way back, for fear of uttering disturbances to him. When we return to the city, it is after 8 o'clock. I drive him to his gym. He gets out of the gym at 10 o'clock, and then I drive him to work. As often as he could, he put the gym in place of the Chelsea Hotel. But in the weeks when Clark went to the hotel more than twice, he concocted other reasons, something novel every week. One evening, fearing that Cindy might have tried to reach Clark while he was in the hotel, he wrote about being stuck in bad traffic in the Holland Tunnel, which has staggeringly deficient phone reception. Another time he wrote that Clark had to hurry to a meeting, so he jumped quickly into a yellow taxi when I was on my way back from picking up Mighty, so I have no way, that is indisputably solid, to know where he was going to or who he was seeing. But I am unequivocal in my belief that he was going to a very crucial meeting. He carried the blue notebook with him at all working hours and presented it to Cindy every morning so she could read it on her way to work. Sometimes she appeared to read every detail, nodding and referencing previous pages. Always, she gave it back to him with no comment besides a quick thanks and a reminder to keep writing. "I will continue writing, madame," he always said as he held the door open for her to step out of the car. "Have a great day, madame." And her days did seem to be getting great, right from around when he began submitting the entries to her. Phone calls with her friends were no longer peppered with teary whispers about what he's doing to me and doubts about how much longer I can go on like this. She was laughing a little more, and by the time Jende gave her 3 weeks' worth of entries, she was laughing a lot more and louder. Her looks did not return to where they'd been the year before. Her skin, though still supple-looking, had lost some of its glow, and her collarbones were sticking out even higher. And she did not stop talking about Vince, worrying that he hadn't responded to her email in 3 days. But she found reasons to smile, like the fact that June and Mike had reconciled, and she and Mighty and Clark were going to St. Bart's for Christmas. It should be a wonderful time, she told her friends, and Jende fervently wished so too, because after months of hearing her groan and sigh, and watching her rest her head against the window with her hand on her cheek and her eyes on the blissful world outside, shake her head, and dejectedly say, "Whatever, Clark, do whatever you want." After seeing too much of the persistent pain she concealed so splendidly when she wasn't around her family and closest friends, he very badly wanted the madame to have a wonderful time. Which was what she seemed to have had when she and Clark attended a gala at the Waldorf Astoria the Monday after Thanksgiving. Clark's parents had come for the holiday, along with his sister and nieces, and days later, Mighty had told Jende what an awesome Thanksgiving his family had had. They had celebrated it with June's family, as they always did, the two families alternated hosting duties every year. And his mother and grandmother and aunt had cooked and baked all day, laughing and telling stories in the kitchen. It was the first Thanksgiving his dad's family had spent together in forever, because with his parents in California and his aunt and cousins in Seattle, it had been hard to get everyone together, considering work schedules and his dad and aunt's shared hatred of holiday travel. But this year, everyone said they had to do it, and it had been so much fun. Jende was surprised to learn that Cindy and her mother-in-law loved each other, because in Limbe, mothers-in-law were often the reason wives stayed up at night crying. But Mighty had told him that no, his mom called his grandparents Mom and Dad, and always made sure to phone them at least once a month, as well as on their birthdays and wedding anniversary. She always insisted Mighty and Vince do the same, and whenever they forgot, she scolded them and reminded them that family was everything. Indeed, Jende could see in Cindy's new joy days after Thanksgiving that the security of family was her greatest source of happiness. Thanks to this rediscovered bliss, hers was no longer a marriage limping from day to day, but one skipping and kicking up its heels and waltzing from evening to evening to Johann Strauss's Voices of Spring. On the day of the Waldorf Astoria Gala, she and Clark entered the car beaming, the happiest Jende had ever seen them, apart or together, in over a year of working for them. Maybe the notebook entries had blown her fears away, Jende thought, assured her that her husband was a good man. Or perhaps the family reunion had reminded her of everything worth fighting for. Or perhaps it was due to something else that had happened between her and her husband, something Jende had no way of knowing. Whatever it was more than sufficient to turn them into young lovers, whispering and giggling on the ride to the gala. She, lustrous in a red strapless trumpet gown. He, youthful and suave in a perfect-fitting tuxedo. They re-entered the car 5 hours later in even greater merriment, laughing about things that had transpired on the dance floor.
I never thought the day would come when I would see Mr. and Mrs. Edwards happy like that,
Jende said to Nenny when he got home after midnight.
Were they kissing and doing all kinds of things in the back seat?
Nenny asked as she placed his dinner on the table.
No, God forbid.
I would have had an accident in 1 minute if I'd seen that.
They were only leaning against each other and speaking into each other's ears, and she was laughing very loud at everything he was saying. He was playing with her hair.
Anyway, I didn't want to look too much, but the whole thing was really shocking me.
I wonder what happened. You think maybe she put a few drops of love potion in his food? The really strong one that makes a man fall for you and treat you like a queen.
Ah, Nenny, Jende said, laughing. American women do not use love potions.
That's what you think?
Nenny said, laughing too.
They use it, they call it lingerie.
Chapter 33. It would be nothing but a blip in a long period of ennui, a brief reprieve from the agony of putrid unions. 2 days after the gala at the Waldorf Astoria, a story would appear in a daily tabloid, and the butterfly their marriage was turning into would morph back into a caterpillar. It was a story that in ordinary times would have been dismissed as rubbish, because really no one with a true sense of the world could be naive enough to think such things didn't happen. If there had been no collective desire to find the presumed architects of the financial crisis despicable, few would have cared to read the story. Its regurgitation in newspapers of record and blogs of repute would have been another reminder why the American society as a whole could never call itself highbrow, why the easy availability of stories on the private lives of others was turning adults, who would otherwise be enriching their minds with worthwhile knowledge, into juveniles, who needed the satisfaction of knowing that others were more pathetic than them. But the story, though it first appeared in an ignoble tabloid, was not dismissed. Rather, it was talked about in barbershops, on playground benches, forwarded to neighbors and classmates. It was a time of anguish in New York City, and those who put the story on the front page knew where they wanted the rage of the downtrodden to flow.
Did you see it?
Leah said to Jende after he had seen her missed call and called her back during his lunch break.
See what? Jende asked.
The story from the prostitute. It's juicy.
Juicy?
Poor Clark. I really hope he's not...
I don't know what you are talking about, Leah.
Oh, honey, you obviously haven't read it,
Leah said excitedly.
Well, you won't believe it. But this woman, this escort, I hate when they use such fancy words for prostitutes. Anyway, she claims she has a lot of clients from Barclays. And listen to this, her clients are paying for her service with bailout money.
Bailout money?
Bailout money! Can you believe it?
Jende shook his head but didn't reply. The bailout thing was in the news every day, but he still didn't understand if it was a good thing or a bad thing.
And you want to hear the crazy part?
Leah went on, her voice getting pitchier in excitement.
One of the executives she mentions as her frequent clients is Clark.
No, Jende immediately said. It's not true.
She says it right here.
It's not true.
How do you know it's not true?
She wrote his name down?
No, she only mentions them by title, and I know Clark's title.
Jende chuckled to himself. Ah, Leah, he said. You should not believe everything.